Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Neurology Webinar Club. I'm Laurent Garrossi, and I'm going to talk to you today about one of my favorite areas, which is feline neurology, and more specifically, we're going to learn together how to deal with the paralyzed cat. As usual, this video will be full of video to make it entertaining for you, but also more practical, and I hope but at the end, you'll be a little bit more confident dealing with a cat with paralysis or other mobility issue. One of the most common mistakes I tend to see when teaching neurology or dealing with referral cases is a tendency for a lot of clinicians to get lost in detail. Always remember what is the main reason the animal is presented to you, and that applies for any neurological presentation, and try to adapt your consultation, and that starts from what question you're going to ask the owner, but also your neurological examination to the main presentation. Like for any other neurological complaint, I always stick to the same model and follow a number of rules. And one of the first rules to actually consider is, are you dealing with a neurological problem in the first place? And that is very relevant when dealing with mobility issue. As you know, mobility involves many body systems. Without a doubt, it involves the nervous system, the central one, with the brain sending message down the spinal cord to send the motor input to the peripheral nerve of the limb. So you got central nervous system, you got peripheral nervous system with the peripheral nerve, but also the junction and the muscle. But you also have the skeleton that is fundamental in generating, in supporting the gait. You got bone, you got joint, you got blood supply as well. And you need to remember that any of these body systems could be affected in an animal with a gait abnormality. So the first thing you should do before to rush to the neurological examination is really to try to rule out non-neurological cause for mobility issue. Showing you a little example of this cat here, you will see that this cat is lame on the left hind limb. And what I'm going to do with a cat like that, before I start testing his postural reaction or reflexes, I am going to do a good orthopedic exam to make sure that I can rule out orthopedic cause for this lameness. So important to look at, obviously, the musculotendinous system, but also the ligament. So I will mobilize all the joints, seeing if there's increase or decrease range of movement, any swelling. And also, I'm going to feel the pulse and look at his pad to make sure that we're not dealing with a vascular problem, so an iliac or aortic thrombosis that could be the cause of this gait abnormality. And only when I'm confident that I've ruled out non-neurological cause by doing this orthopedic exam and checking his pulse, only then I will start to do a neurological exam. Now, the first aim of this neurological exam, which is the second rule I will follow, is to know where should I look, because there is no point to start any diagnostic test until you got a clear idea where you want to focus your investigation. It's the same if you go on a trip, you're not going to start driving with your car without a clear idea of where do you want to go and what path you're going to use. So the path you're going to use is the neurological exam, and where you want to go is which area of the nervous system you want to focus. So you need basically to make an anatomical diagnosis before you actually consider what disease could be there. Anatomical diagnosis imply to find out, am I dealing with a peripheral or a central nervous system? Peripheral being the peripheral nerve, the neuromuscular junction on the muscles, or am I dealing with a central nervous system? And central nervous system disorder, should I look in the brain? Should I look in the spinal cord? And as a reminder, We anatomically, but also from a functional point of view, divide the spinal cord in four functional segments: the C1, C5 segment, the C62, T3, L3, and L4 to S3. So why we try to localize there? For many reasons. As I say, there is no point to start doing diagnostic tests until you need to, you know where to look, because otherwise you may spend a lot of money, waste a lot of time if you're looking at the wrong place. But the other reason why we need to do that is also one of the most common causes of weakness or paralysis in cats is spinal cord disease. You need to be able to differentiate from neuromuscular disease. And because that will influence what kind of diagnostic test you're going to do. With spinal disease, you may consider X-ray, myelogram, CT or MRI, while with neuromuscular disease is a totally different set of investigation. Finally, you may also have mobility issue because you got brainstem or vestibular disorder. And if you got a condition affecting your vestibular system, central or peripheral, that could have an effect on the mobility as well. So the aim of the neurological exam, localize the lesion. Finally, the third reason is that a number of diseases affecting the spinal cord may not show up on all the tests, and that apply, for example, to vascular disease of the spinal cord, ischemic myelopathy. And sometime you may be able to see changes compatible with that on MRI, but if you lose CT myelogram or if you use myelogram, you will only make a diagnosis of ischemic myelopathy by ruling out all the other mimics of an acute onset of myelopathy and also making sure you're looking at the right place. So that's the way we make a diagnosis of exclusion. So coming back to mobility issue, the most common cause is spinal cord disorder, which is what we're going to focus on today. And this spinal cord can be divided in four functional segments. C1, C5 being the cranial cervical, C62 being the cervicothoracic junction, where you got the origin of the peripheral nerve of the front limb, T3, L3 being the third segment, and then you got the L4, S3 segment, which is basically where you got the origin of the peripheral nerve of the hind limb, also the control of the tail, and the control of the urethral and anal sphincter. So by doing a neurological exam, I should be able to confirm I've got a spinal cord disorder, as opposed to, for example, neuromuscular or vestibular, and I can localize to one of these four spinal cord segments. So classically, you may have heard neurologists using terminology like upper and lower motor neuron and so on, and using all sorts of reflex. I'm going to strip all that back and go back to a very simple method to achieve this neurolocalization. And the step that I'm going to follow are on this slide. Step one is to focus on how many limbs are involved. And you don't go until step two until you give a number in terms of what limbs are normal, which limbs are abnormal. And now we're going to do that looking at the gait and then testing the postural reaction to refine this the number of limbs that are involved. Step two, we're going to test a small number of tone and reflexes, but we're only going to do that on the abnormal limb. So if a limb is normal, or identified as normal in step one, you forget about it, and you only do step two on the abnormal limb. And then step three apply mostly for cat with lesion caudal to T3 spinal cord segment, so T3, L3 or L4, S3, we're going to assess bladder function and nociception. Step one, as I say, is to define how many limbs are involved. We're going to do that by looking at the gait and testing the postural reaction. And looking at the gait is probably the most difficult one on a cat, because a cat usually doesn't want to walk when you want him to. So I tend to use a room where there is no place to hide. It's a fairly small room. And I tend, when I examine the cat, to take the cat out of the basket while I talk to the owner to take the history and let the cat be. That gives me an opportunity to keep an eye on how he moves, if he does move, but most cats will want to explore, mostly to find a way to escape or a way to hide, and that gives me a good opportunity to look at the gate. If a cat looks totally collapsed, I'm going to lift the cat to support most of his weight and move the body forward to see is he actually moving this leg normally or not. Finally, a last little trick is if really the other two methods doesn't work, then there's nothing wrong to send the cat home and to ask the owner to video the cat at home and to bring you the video. That could give you a better insight of what mobility issue you're dealing with. Before we dive into the subject, to make sure we're all talking about the same thing, paresis means reduced voluntary movement. So there is some movement, but it's not normal. While plegic means that there is no voluntary movement at all. And then you add the prefix tetra, para, emi, or mono. And tetra means all four, para means only the hind limb, emi means one side of the body, while mono means only one limb. And ataxia means lack of coordination. So with spinal disease, first key take-home message, there is always a combination of paresis and ataxia, and it's very hard, just looking at the cat, to differentiate the two. But remember, we always have a mixture of ataxia and paresis with spinal cord disease. While with neuromuscular disease, you only have weakness, so paresis, but no ataxia. While, for example, another extreme, with cerebellar disease, you only have ataxia, but no paresis. But overall, spinal cord disease, always a combination of ataxia and paresis. So let's look at some examples to put in practice all that. If we look at this video there, what I would like you to do is to look at which limb is normal, which limb is abnormal. So when I look at the cat, I look at his head, if there's any abnormal head movement, head sway, head tilt. I look at all four limbs to assess the gait, but also I look at the tail. And if you look at this video, you will notice that the obvious abnormality is the hind limb. He's making big step on his hind limb. So he's got this kind of spastic paresis. So he's got voluntary movement, but there is a delay in the initiation on the hind limb. But if you look now at the front limb, you will realize that there is a discrepancy between the speed on the front and the hind. He's making a shorter stride on the front while he's making big stride on the hind. The other thing to pick up on that cat is the high tail carriage. You may think that the cat is enjoying being with you, but I'm afraid he's not, and he's only using the tail as a way to balance himself, hence why the high tail carriage. So on that cat, what to take? Definitely the hind limb are abnormal, some spastic paresis, but I've got a question mark on the front. Are they trying to catch up because he's making big step on the hind, or are they part of the same issue? And we'll see in a minute how we can answer that question. So on this cat, two plus or minus the front limb as well. Look at another example, another cat. A bit more obvious on this cat, you can see that both hind limbs are abnormal. There is a mixture of weakness and then coordination. But also important on this cat, you may or may not have noticed, it's got a flaccid tail. Why it is important? Because anatomically, the only way you can get a flaccid tail if you have a lesion in the lower part of the lumbosacral spine. And therefore, combining with the paresis and the ataxia on the hind limb, you can make a strong case that this cat must have an L4 to S3 spinal cord lesion to try to explain both the abnormal gait on the hind limb and the flaccid tail. Another example here. This cat doesn't have any tail, but he may remind you of the first cat. If you look, you will see that this cat is making big step again on his back leg, kind of spastic paresis again, with delay initiation of what we call the protraction phase of the gait. Protraction is when the limbs start moving forward. There seems to be a delay. And then making this big step. And if you look at the front limb, same issue as the first one, is making shorter stride. That's what I tend to call the two-engine cat, but you also apply to the dog. And that could be that all four limbs are abnormal, or he is trying to compensate with his front limb. So, conclusion, just looking at the gait on this cat, both hind limbs are abnormal, question mark about the front, and we'll see in a minute how we clear that issue. And how we clear it is by testing the postural reaction. And classically, the postural reaction are tested in dog by doing the paw positioning and the hopping. And what they do, they test the proprioception. Proprioception is what you see on this diagram there, is the ability of the brain to be aware of your limb and especially the paw position. So when you do the paw positioning, you turn the paw like that, and there should be a sensory proprioceptive message traveling through the sensory peripheral nerve, the spinal cord, to get to the other side of the brain, the forebrain, to say the paw is in the wrong position, send a message back to correct that wrong position. And it's exactly the same that you do when you do the hopping. You displace the cat laterally, lifting the contralateral limb, and it should be able to detect the limb is in the wrong position and hop regularly from one side to another. So the issue with cat is what you're going to see now on this video, is that testing the paw positioning can be a challenge, because this is what tend to happen in most cat. You lift the paw and the cat, you're trying to turn it and the cat will keep lifting it, refuse to put it on the floor. And that's the reason why I tend to prefer testing the hopping. Because unless the cat has severe neurological problem, he will not let you put the paw on the floor. And that's the way I tend to prefer to test the postural reaction, by doing the hopping. So you make the cat hop on all four limbs by lifting the other three limbs, and you're going to compare the speed at which he replaced the paw, but also the weakness, the strength in the hopping. So not only test the proprioception, but also the motor function as well. Much more reliable than doing the paw positioning, unless you got severe neurological lesion there. So looking at the paw positioning, the hopping, you can see another example here on this cat. Try to use a non-slippery mat. He's hopping very well on the right forelimb. And when you compare to the left forelimb, he can hop, but you will see that there is a delay in the hopping. So it's clearly abnormal on the left. And that's a good way for you to understand that the way to assess the postural reaction in general, but even so the hopping, is by comparing the limb between right and left. And that will help you to know, is it actually normal or not? Another example here. Or doing the postural reaction, we do the hopping, and you can see that this cat hop well on the left. But when we make him hop on the right, there is no hopping as well. So in cat, the other thing that I will do, which can be challenging on a big dog, is in addition to the hopping, I also assess the wheelbarrowing. And you're going to see on this cat the hopping on the back leg before we move to the wheelbarrowing. He has no hopping on the right, but it's got good hopping on, or fairly obvious hopping on the left. So wheelbarrowing is another way we test the postural reaction in cat. And you remember this cat was hopping very well on the left, but not on the right. Now look at the wheelbarrowing. You will see now that, yes, the right is the obviously abnormal limb, but the left one is not normal either. So on this cat, all four limbs are affected, but it seems to be worse on the right side. So why do we do the postural reaction? Is to conclude at the end how many limbs are involved. We've seen that with the looking at the gait, sometimes it's obvious which limb is abnormal. But the aim of the postural reaction is not to confirm a limb that you've already identified at the gate as being abnormal. It's mostly to detect subtle abnormality that were not present at the gate, or if you had a doubt, like we've seen on two of these cats looking at the way they walk, if you had a doubt whether or not a limb is normal or not, then you're going to challenge that limb by doing the postural reaction. So that at the end, by combining observation of the gait and the postural reaction, you can make a final conclusion as to which limb are normal or not. Because if at the end you conclude that only the hind limb are affected, then the problem must be behind T2 spinal cord segment, which leave T3, L3 or L4 to S3 as two possible localization. We'll see how we narrow down between these two in a minute. If all four limbs are affected, then that leaves us a few possibilities. The lesion may be C62, C1, C5, potentially brainstem, or generalized neuromuscular. And again, we'll see with step two how we can find out which one of these four localizations we're dealing with. And that moves us nicely to step two. Step two is to look at the tone and the segmental spinal reflexes. Now, if you open most textbooks, you will see there are a large number of spinal reflexes that are described, but practically, there are very few that are reliable in cats. When you test a segmental spinal reflex, the only thing you're testing are sensory nerve, the entumescence corresponding to the limb tested, so C62 on the front, L4, S3 on the hind, the motor nerve, the junction, and the muscle. That's all you tested. So on the front limb, I'm testing that anatomical region. On the hind limb, I'm testing this anatomical region. So anything in white there is not really involved in testing the reflex. But what reflex do we do? You just need to go back to what a limb do. A limb can only do two things. It can extend and it can flex. So the only two thing I will do, and you can do that to all four limbs, looking at the extensor tone. And to do that, you lift the contralateral limb and you see if the cat is able to support his weight on the limb tested. So you don't want any joint to flex, but remain extended. And you can do that on the front and the hind. But also, the other thing that you will test is the flexor withdrawal. And you pinch the toe, you make sure that all the joints are flexing full. And then when it's all flexed, you try to pull the leg toward you and you look at the strength of the withdrawal. So at the end, that will help you to narrow down your localization. So we only test the withdrawal and extensor tone, but the other take home message is we only do that on the limb that you've identified as abnormal in step one. So let's go back to this diagram. Step one, you've identified that only the pelvic limb are affected. We say that the problem in that case must be behind T2 spinal cord segment, which leave T3, L3 or L4 to S3 at two possible suspects. We test the reflex only on the hind limb. If the reflex are intact, it means that this anatomical region is working well. So if that is working well, by default, the problem must be T3 to L3. If, however, either the withdrawal or the extensor tone or both are abnormal, then the problem must be L4 to S3 or S1. If all four limbs are affected, we've seen that there are a number of possibilities. It could be C1, C5, C62 or generalized neuromuscular, and I should add to that brainstem. However, if it is brainstem, I would expect maybe mentation abnormality, maybe vestibular signs as well. So a bit easier to pick up. But when all four limbs are affected, the important thing is to know, is it cervical myelopathy or is it a neuromuscular problem? So again, we're going to test the reflex on all four limbs. If they are intact on all four, then the problem must be C1, C5. If they are abnormal on the front limb, but normal on the hind, the problem must be C6 to T2. If the reflex are abnormal on all four limbs, then we must be dealing with a neuromuscular disorder. So looking at an example on this cat, and that to illustrate how do I look at the reflex, I do all my neuro exam on the floor. On this cat here, put the cat between my thigh, that allowed me to look at the withdrawal reflex and I look at the strength. And then to look at the extensor tone, I can leave the contralateral limb, putting the cat on his feet, or in the hind limb, I can do the patellar reflex. To do that, I put the cat like that, the limb end up being semi-flex, and then I can tap the patellar tendon and compare between right and left. I'm not a big fan of the patellar reflex. I personally prefer to use the extensor tone, much more reliable and easy to elicit. And if you want to do the rest of the neuro exam while the cat is on his back, you can do all that while he's on the floor like that. So another example here, this cat was tetraparetic non-ambulatory. We look at the withdrawal reflex. You can see a pinch there. He know I'm pinching, but he's unable to withdraw the limb. So he's got decreased withdrawal reflex on the front limb, while on the hind limb, he's got good withdrawal reflex. When I pinch there, he's flexing. He's got a cross extensor as well. So on this cat, as shown on this diagram there, reflex are intact on the hind, abnormal withdrawal on the front. The problem must be C6 to T2. Another example here, a cat with T3, L3 myelopathy. We look at the cat walking. Again, look at the high tail carriage. The hind limb are abnormal, mixture of weakness and ataxia. The front limb appear normal. So what we do next on this cat, we look at the posterior reaction to detect subtle abnormality that we may have missed on evaluation of the gait and focusing especially on the front limb to conclude at the end whether or not they are normal or not. So we're going to look at the posterior reaction, we make him hop. You can see that he's hopping very well on the front. So they appear normal to me. That is abnormal on the hind limb. So conclusion, step one, only the hind limb are affected. The front limb are normal. Step two, I'm going to do the reflex, but only looking at the hind limb and focusing on extensor tone and withdrawal reflex. Put the cat between my leg. We're going to do the withdrawal reflex and we can do the patella while he's lying nicely like that. Again, sometimes you can do it, sometimes you can't on the cat. Good patella reflex there. And now we do the withdrawal reflex. Good withdrawal reflex. So conclusion on this cat. Reflex are intact on the hind limb. By default, we must have a T3, L3 spinal cord lesion. We can go a little bit further in looking at the L4 to S1 spinal cord segment, which is the entumescence for the hind limb. And there are two major nerves on the hind limb, the femoral and the sciatic nerve. Femoral start at L4 to L6 spinal cord segment, while the sciatic, L6 to S1 spinal cord segment. The femoral is responsible for the extensor of the knee, so quadriceps contraction, while the sciatic is responsible for the flexion of the knee, the flexion and extension of the tarsus. So let's look at some video to see that sometime, looking at the gait, we may be able to differentiate and to recognize specific nerve involvement. So this cat was the one that I used to illustrate the importance of ruling out orthopedic problem before you do a neuro exam. And you can see that this cat has a left hind limb lameness. But importantly, after doing an orthopedic exam, ruling out any issue there, you need to consider how can I describe the gait. And apart from saying this cat is lame, the best way to describe is that every time the cat is putting weight on that limb, he is unable to extend his stifle. Consequently, There is a drop every time you put weight there. And what is responsible for the extension of the stifle is the quadriceps muscle, which is under control by the femoral nerve. So let's look at the hand-on neurological exam on that cat. We do the posterior reaction to make sure we haven't missed subtle deficit on the other limbs than the left hind. And there were the hopping is normal. Now looking at the hopping on the left, not only is abnormal, but there is a decreased extensor tone. Extensor tone on the right is great, but look on the left, unable really to extend the stifle. So that again will confirm that there is a problem affecting the femoral on the left, either at the level of the entumescence on the left side, L4 to L6, or at the level of the femoral nerve itself. Looking at another example there, you will quickly notice that this cat has two things, a flaccid tail and a plantigrade stance. Now, a lot of people will jump thinking is a cat, he's got plantigrade stance, is diabetic. No, because diabetes, yes, can cause peripheral neuropathy, but in cat often manifests with a plantigrade stance, but many neuropathy will be like that. But if it was a polyneuropathy, it should not affect the tail like that. And the only way, again, to have a flaccid tail, remember what we discussed earlier, is to have a lesion affecting the L4 to S3 spinal cord. So on this cat, he must have a lesion there. But can we be a bit more precise? Is it more L4 to L6 or L6 to S3 spinal cord segment? Looking at the stance, not only he's got a flaccid tail, but also this cat is unable to extend his tarsus. When you pinch the toe, there is no withdrawal reflex, no flexion of the tarsus, and no flexion of the stifle. And remember what we say, sciatic nerve responsible of the flexion of the stifle, extension and flexion of the tarsus. So on that cat, he has bilateral sciatic nerve disorder, which could be the sciatic nerve itself, so a polyneuropathy. But we've already said that because of the tail involvement, it must be a myelopathy or spinal cord disease. And therefore, the conclusion on this cat is a L6 to S3 spinal cord lesion. So we've seen that with this stepwise approach, step one and step two, you should be able to localize the lesion as to is it spinal and where in the spine is the issue. Step three is to look at the bladder function and nociception. It's something that we mostly do with a lesion, either T3, L3 or L4 to S3, because a cervical lesion should not affect the bladder. And with regard to nociception, yes, you may lose nociception with a cervical myelopathy, but you will lose before that the respiratory drive, and therefore the animal will be in such a state that the priority won't be to assess nociception, but ventilation on this cat or dog. So with regard to the bladder, the two type of bladder dysfunction we have depend on where the lesion is. If it's T3 to L3, the problem is going to be the voiding phase, where the issue with a T3, L3 myelopathy that is severe enough is that the brain is not getting the message from the bladder that the bladder is full. And therefore, the bladder will keep filling up, the sphincter will be tight, but there will be no brain initiation of micturition. And you will only have urine coming out when the pressure is so high in the bladder that you overcome the urethral sphincter. The other type of bladder dysfunction is the one affecting more the sacral segment of the spinal cord, and in that case is affecting the storage phase. And the reason is that the storage is need a urethral sphincter to be tight, and if you got a lesion affecting the sacral segment of the spinal cord, it will cause a weak urethral sphincter. So you will have a bladder that is not only flaccid, but the urine will always come out due to the lack of urethral tone. The nociception is important to assess if you got a paraplegic cat. And the nociception is the last spinal cord function to disappear. And there, schematically, is represented the different type of cable in the spinal cord, the more superficial being the proprioceptive, and therefore the first one to be affected. Then the next cable to be affected are the motor cable, then the cable that join the bladder to the brain to inform the brain that the bladder is full, and then the last one is the nociceptive cable. Now, be very careful when you assess nociception. Nociception is the ability of an animal to feel pain, and the way it manifests is if you pinch, you want the animal to turn, to try to bite, as opposed to purely withdraw the limb. So withdrawal is a reflex. It doesn't tell you that the brain is getting the message. What you want to know is the cat to turn and to react, to meow, to bite, or to try to scratch you when you go that. So not to confuse, but not also to confuse your pet owner, I would recommend as a little tip that when you test nociception, you manually flex the limb. And when the limb is flexed, then you take a little piece of artery forceps and you pinch a nail at the base, and you see if it reacts in terms of behavioral manifestation as opposed to the withdrawal. So why we test the nociception? Because it has a prognostic indicator. And we've seen that the spinal cord is made of different cable, and they tend to be lost in a defined order, but also they tend to recover in the reverse order. So this is the basis for T3, L3 myelopathy or L4 to S3 myelopathy of a grading system on a scale of 1 to 5. And depending on the number of spinal cord function that has been lost, we assign a grade. Grade 1 being the least severe, grade 5 is an animal that is paraplegic, with no nociception and no bladder function. Why we do that? Because the clinical grading is, at the moment, the only way we have to ascertain the prognosis, depending on what disease you consider in your differential. So, for example, although it hasn't been very well defined in cat, but in dog is much more defined, if you are a dog with a disc restriction and you're paraplegic grade 5, which means no nociception, you got about 60% chance of recovery if surgery is done in the first 24 to 48 hours. In cat, we don't have such information. We have some value, but we are limited in terms of numbers. If, for example, you got a cat with that has been involved in road traffic accident and is presented to you, and after systemic stabilization is grade 5, then the prognosis will be less than 10%. So you see that this grading system is a way to communicate with your pet owner to give them an idea of what the outcome could be depending on what differential you have in mind. But it's also a way for you to nurse the cat. For example, if you have a grade 5, you know that you must address the bladder, either manual expression or catheterization. And also, things tend to recover the reverse way. So if you had a grade 5 cat and is starting to move the leg, then in theory, this cat should be able to have normal bladder function. How do we establish the differential diagnosis? We come back to the same tip that we tend to use for any other neurological condition. We use this vitamin D. And if you don't remember, each of these letters in this mnemonic stand for a disease process. And we use that because each disease process that can affect the nervous system tend to have a typical mode of onset and progression. So vascular disease, as an example, will have a sudden onset, like traumatic disease, and then the sign will either slowly get better with time or remain the same if there's permanent damage. While inflammatory, infectious, and neoplastic disease will have a more insidious onset, while degenerative disease will have a very, very slow and insidious onset and an irreversible progression. Metabolic disease tend to wax and wane. And that's why it's very important when you assess the cat is to ask the owner a key question about the mode of onset, how and when does it occur, and the possible progression of the sign. Has it got worse? Has it remained the same? Or has it got slowly better? Because that will help you to narrow down your differential. But what will be common spinal disease in cats? They are represented there using again the vitamin D, and highlighted are what I tend to see more commonly. In terms of vascular disease, ischemic myelopathy is probably one of the most common acute myelopathy in cats. Inflammatory disease are far less common. We refer as non-infectious meningomyelitis. And the diagnosis is made by documenting we've got an inflammatory process, mostly with CSF, and making sure you rule out infectious cause, the most common one being FIP, but also to consider toxoplasmosis, and depending where you live, and maybe over infectious agent, including fungal agent, to rule out. Traumatic disease, fracture luxation, fairly common. Disc herniation can happen in cat, but far less common than it is in dog. Moving on to infectious, the most common infectious agent is definitely FIP, and even so on a cat that is less than 2 years of age. I would say that would be very high in my differential. And finally, other common spinal disease would be lymphoma and lymphosarcoma. So you see that slightly different from dog, most common one, FIP, lymphoma, ischemic myelopathy, and obviously traumatic disease. I'm not going to talk about all these specific diseases. That will be a totally different webinar, but just to give you an idea of what you need to consider. And then let's look at a couple of pitfalls of the lesion localization. One of the common pitfalls, and I regularly get caught myself, I'm afraid, is to differentiate spinal disease from neuromuscular disease. Looking at this drawing there, you realize that if you got disease affecting the neuromuscular system, which encompass peripheral nerve, junction of muscle, that is going to affect your segmental spinal reflex and tone. So how do we recognize neuromuscular disease? All four limbs will be affected on step one, at the gait and the posterior reaction. But when you do step two, you're going to have reduced tone and reduced flexor withdrawal on all four limbs. So why do I get caught? Because sometimes disease can progress very, very slowly. And while in dog they show clear sign of neuromuscular weakness in terms of flexor withdrawal, in cat it may be more difficult to get your head around, is that withdrawal normal or not? And that's why, you know, regularly I end up looking for a cervical myelopathy, find nothing, and then a day or two down the line, the cats start to show more obvious sign of reduced withdrawal on all four, pointing me now to a neuromuscular disorder. So, mistake happen. Don't be embarrassed. What is an issue is that if you don't review the situation in the face of normal finding. The other mimic of spinal disease is the one that you're going to see on this video, which I hope you're far more familiar, is the example of the cat that become fairly suddenly paraparetic or paraplegic. And we come back to the first rule that I discussed in this webinar, ruling out non-neurological condition first. So orthopedic disease, definitely. You know, you could have a cat walking like that with, for example, pelvic fracture, and he won't be able to move the limb like this cat. But the other thing to rule out, apart from orthopedic disease, is to rule out ischemic neuromyopathy. So lack of blood supply to the muscle and the nerve, and the common cause for that is aortic or iliac thromboembolism. Typically, this cat will have swollen muscle, and it's difficult to see on this video, but the muscle are swollen, they feel hot, the nail bed will be gray, and the pad will be also discolored. Typically, this cat will have also no nociception when you pinch. And the reason for that, as you see on this video, is that there is lack of blood supply to the peripheral nerve, so not only the motor information is not getting there, but also the sensory information as well. So, quick couple of slides on ischemic neuromyopathy. The most common cause is aortic thromboembolism. Sometimes it could be the external iliac artery that are occluded, and that could explain why they can sometimes present a monoparesis or plegia as opposed to affect both back leg. In cat, it is in the large majority of cat the tip of an iceberg, the iceberg being secondary myocardial disease, especially HGM, and very often that prompts you to do an echocardiogram where you will be, in a lot of cases, be able to document not only the presence of HGM or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, but also the presence of a thrombus in the left atrium. They tend to present with para or monoparesis, and sometimes it could also affect the front limb, but far less common. Clinically, they will have a weak or absent femoral pulse. They are painful on palpation and the muscles are quite swollen, and the pad will be not only discolored but also cold, and also having cyanotic nail bed. Very important to take the body temperatures to check for hypothermia and also to listen to their heart as well, and a lot of this cat will be tachypneic and dyspneic as well. To document the thrombus, ultrasound will be useful. However, it could be very difficult to document the involvement of the external iliac artery, and that's why, you know, sometimes doing CT angiogram will be the way to confirm the diagnosis, as shown on this picture on the right, where the left show you the thrombus on the Doppler ultrasound. Remember to always look for cardiomyopathy and don't stop at the diagnosis of the ischemic neuromyopathy. A lot of this cat will improve. However, the long-term prognosis will be very poor, and the published data is that 60% will die or will euthanize after the first episode, or at least in the first year. And predictor of the outcome will be the presence of hypothermia and congestive heart failure. So the way to manage this cat is purely by giving this cat clopidogrel or aspirin. You hope that there will be some reperfusion with time, and the aim of the medical management is to try to prevent relapse, but ultimately they will have relapse, and I should add to the management treatment of the underlying heart disease if at all possible. So to summarize this presentation, remember when presented with a cat with mobility issue to rule out non-neurological problem. So we talk about orthopedic disease, but also vascular supply to the limb, so aortic or iliac thromboembolism. Next step is to determine which limb are abnormal by looking at the gait and challenging the limb by doing the postural reaction. For the postural reaction, the aim is to detect subtle abnormality that were not obvious at the gait. And I will prefer in a cat to do the hopping plus or minus the wheelbarrowing. You move then to step two, where you only focus on the abnormal limb, looking at the withdrawal and the extensor tone. I put forget the hammer because also I show you some example where I could elicit a patellar reflex on the cat. That's more the exception than the rule, but you can circumvent that by looking at the extensor tone, which involves the same anatomical reflex as the patellar reflex. And finally, the last take-home message is not to confuse withdrawal reflex with nociception, which are two different things you're testing. That's it. I hope that this presentation will make you a bit more confident dealing with a cat with mobility issue, and I'd be happy to take any question you may have. Thank you very much for your attention. Have a good day. So there is a question about how common is slip disc in cat. Well, Far less common than dog, I should say, especially chondrodystrophic dog. Cats tend to get more disc extrusion than protrusion when they are clinically relevant. And I use the term clinically relevant because often we do MRI of all the cat for mobility issue, and we may find a number of protruded discs, but they are mild, so they can suffer from disc degeneration. However, disc extrusion can happen in cat. And for some reason, we don't know why, while in dog is very common in the thoracolumbar region, in cat is quite common in the caudal lumbar region, especially L4, L5, or L5 to L6. And the way we treat them is exactly the same. If there is sufficient compression to explain the neurological deficit, then we do the same type of surgery, so hemilaminectomy. Cervical disc disease in cat is very, very rare. So I cannot remember doing a ventral slot on the cat, so very, very rare in this case. There's another question about this so-called explosive disc or high-velocity, low-volume disc. Yes, it is another differential of acute myelopathy in cat. You may be more familiar of that in dog. That's what we call a high-velocity, low-volume disc or acute non-compressive nuclear disc extrusion. It is also happening in cat, mostly following a fall from a height. And the way we manage them is purely conservatively. It is a disc extrusion, but there is no minimum compression. So again, no justification for surgery. And a lot of these cats will do well with purely conservative management, pending that they retain nociception. I don't think there's any more questions, so that leaves me to wish you a good day, and I hope that you've enjoyed this presentation. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Laurent for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.